Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio in association with Stony Brook Southampton Graduate Arts. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination.
And today, legendary songwriter Paul Simon.
On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand, and every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band. Homeward bound, I wish I was.
Paul Simon doesn't often give interviews. He occasionally tours, recently with Sting, but mostly Simon lives a quiet life at home in Connecticut with his wife, singer Edie Brickell. There he spends his time making music and writing songs. He's written hundreds, a large number of which are among the most popular and admired in music history. Bridge Over Troubled Water, Kodachrome, Slip Slidin' Away, Graceland, to name a few. Over the years, the way he creates his songs has changed.
The process has evolved. There's still elements of it that are like my first instincts about writing, but otherwise it's become much slower and much more complicated, I think. Well, of course, it's entwined with record making with me, that's singing both. And it's a complicated process now. It's, to do it abstractly without referring to one particular song probably wouldn't show you as much as if I gave you an example. But,
well, describe what it was like before. They just came ripping out of you all the time.
I was never a really fast writer, but when I was in my early 20s, and I wrote all the songs for, all the beginning songs for Simon and Garfunkel, that came pretty fast. I was living partly here and partly in England, and within a 5-year period of, from like 1965 to 1969, I wrote, most of my big hits, Bridge Over Troubled Water, The Sound of Silence, Mrs. Robinson, The Boxer, Homeward Bound, I Am a Rock,
America.
Let's see, America, Feeling Groovy was a hit for somebody else. So I was faster, but now I'm much slower. This last group of songs that I've been working on has been probably taking me about 3 years. But it isn't like I finish a song and go on to the next. I just keep working on the songs. So some of them are like
in
a work
way?
In progress that's like 3 years.
Perfectionism.
No, I don't like that word because it implies...
I've got about 9 questions that use the word perfectionism in them, so I'll delete those questions.
Well, I just don't think it's like any performance. If I said to you, Alec, you're just like, you're just a perfectionist, why do you want to take another take? It was great. You're a perfectionist. Your answer would be, there's no perfect. I'm not going for perfect. Yeah. I'm going for something that I know... And I know it when it happens.
For me,
that's what you would say as a performer.
As close as I can to what I think is it.
Right.
It takes time.
But even if you got it 100%, you wouldn't say, well, this is a perfect performance. You'd say, no, I realized my vision, or I realized how I wanted to play this. But you wouldn't describe it as perfect, right? Perfect doesn't have anything to do with the whole thing.
No, for me, so, perfect is out of the question.
It is out of the question. It's like Japanese temples where they always leave some imperfection in a Zen temple because the idea of striving for a perfect temple is an affront to, God. It's not possible for man to do a thing without with no imperfections.
When you write music now, is there like a state you want to get into? Is there a place? Is there a whole... You want to be left alone for a couple of hours to think about it? I mean,
I find I'm basically thinking about this all the time when I'm not thinking about, my wife and family or some little crisis that comes up or something like that. If my mind is just, free to go where it wants to go, it goes to the songs I'm working on constantly, just all the time.
when you wrote music before, were there any of them that just came right out of you? And yeah, you just sat down, boom.
Well, sometimes they do. In the early ones, of course, like The Sound of Silence, I wrote that when I was 21 years old, and I have no idea. Couldn't have taken very long, but I mean, I have no idea how I even wrote that song because, and at the time, it wasn't like I was really surprised that I wrote it. I thought, this is good. This is a good song, but I had no idea what that was. Mm-hmm. Same with Bridge Over Troubled Water. You know, I wrote it. I said, this is better than I usually write. This is a good song. But I didn't know that it was going to be a song that was going to be 50 years and people, you know, would know it for, you know.
The songs you've made that have been in film soundtracks, were you appreciative of that and grateful for that?
Yeah, it depends.
Depends.
On that. Depends on how they were used or some, you know. Look, there's no time that I could say I object to the way my song is used in your movie. Because, I mean, if I objected that much, I don't have to give them a license. I control my publishing. So, I mean, sometimes I think, oh, this is really good. You know, like what did I see the other day? Anderson's film about the family.
Wes Anderson? Tenenbaums?
Yeah, the Tenenbaums.
Royal Tenenbaums.
The Royal Tenenbaums, right. I just saw the Royal Tenenbaums again the other day. I hadn't seen it probably in, I don't know what, 10 years or something like that, 8 years or something. And they used me and Julio in there, and it's perfect. Comes in, I said perfect. Well, I could say it about somebody else's work. Anyway, it's a very good choice. It sort of explodes in a joyous way.
That's when Hackman goes on the joyride with the kids.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. I narrated that film. That's why I know that film.
Oh, uh-huh.
I mean, I love his films. He's such an oddball.
Yeah, I like his films a lot. And I really like that one, which I hadn't seen in a while. And I love Gene Hackman's performance. In that.
Was Cape Man the only musical you did? Were there others that were on the drawing board? That was the only one.
No.
You ever attempted, conceived, nothing. That was it.
Yeah, it takes so long to make them. Well, it takes me a long time to do anything, you know, But it took a long time to make the Cape Man. That was about 5 years.
And the idea began when?
The idea was, I think it was after Graceland and the Rhythm of the Saints. I said, well, I mean, it's time to do something else. I know, how do I follow those albums, or, you know? So I'll take my hand at a musical. And then that kid, Sal Agron, he's just in my memory from when I grew up here. So I picked him because that would mean that the music would be doo-wop, and also he was Puerto Rican, so that means there would be Latin music in there too. So to me, I said, I could be interested in listening to a musical that was doo-wop and Latin. I like both of them. I think it would be a nice, and here's a story. So that's how I picked it. You know, that's why I did it. And, you know, I mean, as it turns out, we didn't do it very well. And
what do you mean by that? Why? What would you have done differently, looking back in retrospect?
I shouldn't really put it that way. It was notably unsuccessful.
Right. But I think people still...
Critically and everything. And there were serious flaws with it as a piece, but actually a lot of it was really good.
I mean, I think a lot of people were thrilled by the attempt that you made. People who were, you know...
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't professionally like... Professionally malicious.
Yeah.
There's a lot to like in that.
Yeah, it brought a lot of goodwill. People liked it, and... But it wasn't a success. But when it came back at BAM, I don't know, whatever it was, 7-8 years ago, and then when it was done in Central Park 2 years after that, they were both successful. Anyway, I think it was a very interesting piece, and I'm not by any means embarrassed by it. I think there's some really good things in there. It's certainly the best doo-wop song I ever wrote is in there. But anyway, I don't really have any interest in doing it again.
You don't?
No.
Are there other things you think of? Do you think about films, just scoring film? Never. That was the one deviation for you. Cape Man.
No, it's not something that I think of. But if somebody came to me with a really interest, like, for example, there's a an old friend of mine who's a playwright, and he asked me if I would write some guitar music to a new play that he wrote. And I said, yeah. It's kind of an interesting idea, but I wouldn't think to myself, I'd love to write some guitar music for a theatrical piece.
What about make films?
If somebody came to me with an idea, I might be very excited by it. But really what I think about naturally is writing songs and making records. And I'm really content to not do anything other than that because I'm still learning about that. So I think it's getting better. And as the work sort of, the work getting better is a manifestation of me understanding things that I've been working on for, you know, a long time. Some things like, you know, decades and decades.
For example?
I don't have a specific example. I'm just thinking about how you over decades learn a sense of what words to stay away from, what words to go to, how rhythm could be used, how melody. You just learn, you know, from your craft.
It's interesting you say what words to stay away from. That's interesting.
In different circumstances, you would want to stay away from certain
words. You love words. You were going to be a lawyer, correct?
No, I never. I went to law school for a year, but that was a complete misunderstanding of who I was by me.
Where'd you go?
Brooklyn Law.
And for how long? 1 year.
Yeah.
What was it like?
It was so boring. I wasn't interested in it. I had no reason to be there.
Was it your idea?
Yeah.
You weren't responding to some pressure.
It was my idea. No. No, what happened was a bunch of my friends in college were going to take the law board. So they said, you should take them. So I was an English major, but I said, okay, I'll take them. And I took them and I scored very high on them. So, you know, at 20 years old or whatever, you know, I said, I don't know, maybe I'm supposed to be a lawyer or something. I mean, if I scored so high on these, so I don't know. You know, so I went and, you know, did a year of in Brooklyn.
So the year in Brooklyn...
I had made that record with Artie by then anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Columbia deal in 64?
Yeah, so we had made this Wednesday morning 3 a.m. and the acoustic version of The Sound of Silence in 1964, right. You know? So I was at school then, and I probably wrote it then. You know, I don't remember when I wrote it, but a year or two before we recorded it. You know, so anyway, it was just one of those, you know, could have wasted it on a lot of worse things than that,
sure.
I suppose. But I was going to England, and every break I had, I was going to England. I had my friends there, I had my girlfriend there, and then the first semester at school, I got B's, and I wasn't showing up or doing anything. And I said, this is, you know, I don't know. It's ridiculous. The next semester, I got all D's, you know. And I said, you know, I mean, the truth is, I just don't want to be this.
Right.
You know, I don't want to be here. So I'm leaving. You know, it's not like I said, oh, well, now I better really dig in if I don't want to get a D. I just said, I'm just totally indifferent. I'm just in the wrong place. And I went and I moved to England. And,
Was your girlfriend the one at that time, Kathy, the one who you married?
No, Kathy, yeah. Okay. Who has, of you know, the songs about her. You've got a whole list of questions. Are these questions that you're interested in or the questions that you think people will be interested in?
I get a list of questions that I have a producer write, and some volume of them I use, but I write a lot of my own questions because mm-hmm. you know, the basic principle is I want people to describe for me, in the whether it's you, whether it's Obama, it doesn't matter who it is, everybody I want them to describe, how has it felt to be you? Really, that's the basic premise of the show.
What about if somebody doesn't want to describe that?
They're free to do whatever they please.
Maybe they don't even want to describe that to themselves.
Well, maybe some people...
In other
people,
words, it's a way of thinking about life is what you're saying.
Some people here and after about 20 minutes, they begin to have a conversation that I think that they wanted to have. I mean, my next question for you is, what did your parents think when you were so young? Did your parents have any kind of opinion about your career at that age? You were 16 years old when you were on American Bandstand?
Oh, I don't think that anybody thought of it as a career. I thought they were, you know, happy. I made a record. The record got played on the radio. It was, kind of a hit. We went on television.
What did they think about that?
They were happy. You know, my father was a professional bass player, and he was used to be on some television shows that, you know, like the Arthur Godfrey Show.
Sure.
He was in that band, and Jackie Gleason, he was on that band. So, I mean, it wasn't that it was out of the question that you would ever see somebody on television, because, like, we'd, you know, when we were kids, let's see if we see Dad, you know, when they show the band. But so, you know, it's not exactly a show business family, but it's not exactly civilian either. You know, he was a good musician. I'm sure he didn't think that the piece of work that we did was very good, but he was happy that
it
was a hit.
Did that change?
Did it change what his opinion about my work?
Right.
Yeah, of course.
Sure. I wonder what that was like for him.
Well, you know, it's a very, very interesting question, and one that I think about a lot. But I really do think that it's like one of those questions that, even though there's nothing in the response that would be hurtful or anything, it's just one of those things where, like, it's sort of my life, you know? Like, it's very entertaining, I know, for people, but why should I do that?
Yeah, not the kind of thing you want to talk about.
Yeah, I don't think so. Oh. How he felt about, you know, me. Obviously, it was like, it is a very interesting subject and a complex subject, you know. And I think about it a lot because, as you can imagine, it would provoke all kinds of responses in parent-child relationships. But everything happens to everybody. You know, it's not like there's anything of mine that is that different from anybody else's experiences that I should, you know,
open up,
bequeath it that much more time. You know, it's like there was something up, something was off, you know, but I was crazy about him. I'm sure he was crazy about me. And if there was a complication in it, then... okay, it's like, as opposed to, let me figure out what that complication was and let's talk about it. So let's go to, another subject. I don't mean to be rude. Do you want to ask me another question about that? Or
the only reason I ask is because, I mean, for me, my dad died when I was 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he never got to see any of what I did. And I'm always interested in people's relationships with their parents in terms of just how it may or may not affect what you do. You know,
just anecdotally, I noticed that people whose childhoods are more troubled than mine was, but, you know, had some kind of hardships, usually money issues or something like that, or family or broken, you know, divorce, or, you know, that... there's more interest in the subject than I naturally feel about it, having grown up with just my younger brother in a peaceful, loving family. I mean, I can say that I really wanted to get out of there, you know, but...
for what purpose?
You just, you know, I was ready.
To be who you wanted
to be. Yeah, I was free. You know, I just wanted to be free. So there's a picture of my my son, Adrian, that I love. He's sitting in a snowsuit. He looks like he's maybe a year old. He's sitting in the snow in Central Park. And the look of exasperation on his face is so profound that I know it's like he was already whoever he was, and he just, you know, said, oh, man, do I have to go through this whole thing to get up to, you know, he was that guy already. And whoever I was, people weren't prepared for what it is that I was in the world that I came from. Nobody said, well, will you make your living as an artist? Like, that wasn't a possibility. Certainly you couldn't make your living as a rock and roll artist. And, I mean, forget about, like, the greatest songwriters or something like that. Just even a songwriter, you know, like, you're going to, like, be a songwriter? Or something. So nobody was saying anything particular, like, wow, you're really gifted. You should, you know, do this, study that. You know, it was, like, great. My father's thing was great. You know, you can do this. You know, it's better than waiting on tables, you know? Be a musician, but don't be a musician for your whole career. But I was already long gone into that.
Paul Simon's career in music has made an indelible mark. Simon and Garfunkel won the Grammy for Lifetime Achievement, and Simon himself belongs to an elite club of musicians inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice. Other members include Michael Jackson, Lou Reed, Paul McCartney, and John Lennon. Take a listen to our archives where I speak with another musician with a long and storied career, Radiohead's frontman Tom York. You've been with those guys for how long now?
We started when we were 16. Mm-hmm. Radiohead, so that's quite a while.
What do you attribute that to?
Persistence. My great diplomatic skills. Not.
More at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. As the story goes, Paul Simon met Art Garfunkel during a sixth-grade production of Alice in Wonderland. 4 years later, they signed with a label under the pseudonym Tom and Jerry, and their song Hey Schoolgirl reached the Billboard charts. Today, Paul Simon has 12 Grammys, and in 2007, he became the first recipient of the Library of Congress's Gershwin Prize for Popular Song. Paul never stops working on his music, and he brought a CD of some of his latest songs to our interview.
I guess it's an album. You know, I don't even know what it is anymore because I'm working on a group of songs, and I've been working on them for a long time. And I'm also working on different sounds. And, you know, as you combine things from different places, and you find a way of expressing yourself by doing that, there's something calming about that. It's good, and it sort of spills you into the rest of your life. You start to problem solve in the same way. You start to just have a certain connection that you sense, and you believe in it, and you go with it. And if I have to break down what my instincts are cerebrally and tell you why, I can. You know, but it's not really necessary for me to get in the way of whatever the flow is going to give me. And then, you know, after I've reached a certain amount of songs, I cut it off and say, okay, that's this group. I'll take a look and see, is that something, you know, what is it? Well, I've just finished it. What is it now? You know, because it's not the same process as like a movie company says, here, I want to make a movie. You know, here's what it is. Here's the budget. And when you finish it, we'll judge it. You know, but in the context that you're making it is a certain context. I'm not doing that. I'm just finishing a bunch of songs and then saying, what is that mean? And my first real question is like, what does that mean to somebody else who's listening to it?
Do you have a producer?
No, I
produce. all the albums you've made over the many, many years, how many of them, what percentage would you say you had a producer?
It doesn't matter. They weren't really.
They weren't.
You know,
they
helped me.
Self-determining.
They helped me. And, well, look, there can be a producer who says, let's pick the songs and then you go, we'll get the musicians and we'll do it like this. And the artist says, okay, well, I do that. I make up the songs, I make up the sounds. What I need to work with in a collaboration is a great engineer, and I am working with one.
You do it all in the same studio?
I do it up in a little studio in my house.
Right. You record everything there?
Well, no, if there are bigger things like drums or something like that, I might not do it. I might do it in a studio, but I have to record the drums there too. Well, the other day we went up to this church in Hartford, and we recorded a big pipe organ to put on one of the tracks. It's interesting. Anyway, you know, you would know what I was talking about if you had heard any of this and your reaction to it was, oh, I like that. I like to hear it again. That's entertaining. I like it. You know, because most music that you hear that's new, it's like, you know, Steve Martin's got a great joke. And he says, well, I'd like to play a new song for you now. He said, you know, if you're like me, when an artist says they'd like to play a new song, I always think, please don't, you know. And it's very hard to get anybody to really like something that you're doing that's new. Or to like anything, really.
I did SNL once, and Lorne had me tip McCartney and hand him a wad of money at the opening and say, only the old stuff, Paul, please, only the old stuff. And I slip him a $20 bill or something. But, but you're right. No one wants to hear the new stuff.
Unless it's really good.
Right.
It's that people have heard enough stuff that isn't good that they now are wary. You know, when people were really interested in songs and stuff, like if you go to the 60s or that, into that period of, you know, people were really interested to see if what was your new song. They didn't dread it. They dread it now because people don't have any particularly great ideas with their new song. You're better off going to a new artist.
Do you listen to music now?
All the time.
You devour, I wouldn't say devour, but do you listen to a lot of music? For what purpose? Beyond pleasure, beyond consuming it like everybody else does. What's music in your life?
Wait, what purpose? Beyond pleasure?
But
do you
know
need
what I mean?
Like,
you
need a purpose? You don't need a purpose.
Well, you don't listen to things to find out what people are doing.
In popular music?
Right.
No.
Well, I'm just curious, yeah.
No, I don't much listen to popular music. You just ask me if I listen to music.
Right. What kind of music?
All kinds. Right.
Everything.
You know, old music, new classical music, music from different composers, odd composers, gospel music, country music, jazz. It depends. If I'm driving in the car, I have this like this 5 or 6 stations programmed, and like, what are they? Well, 50s, Sinatra, Willie's.
Sinatra channel.
I have the Sinatra channel.
That's all I
Willie's Place, Elvis Presley, which is a very disappointing channel.
Yeah.
I think B.B. King's Bluesville, and one other, it might be another jazz. The sources that I am drawing from are far enough afield, I think, that you don't think to yourself, you know, I'm listening to this in the context of my music. For example, there's a composer named Harry Partch, and he's dead now. He died in the 70s. He was born in the West Coast in the early part of the 20th century. Anyway, Harry Partch's belief was that an octave is not divided into 12 notes, like you see on a piano. If you go from C to C, including black keys and white keys, it's 12 notes. He said that's a false division of the way music occurs. Really, an octave has about 43 distinct notes. And in order for him to compose this microtonal music, he had to build instruments that played microtonally. Anyway, this composer, his instruments were out at Montclair State in New Jersey, and I made contact. One of the guys in my band knew the guy who was curating those instruments, and he played Harry Parch music. His name was Dean Drummond. He died about a year and a half ago. But anyway, I got into this thought that this song that I wrote would be very good in a context of this microtonality. So I went out there and recorded it and put the song down, and, you know. So I can't say that I'm listening to find out something. I'm not listening and saying, what are you doing? Oh, let's see. Oh, that's right. That's hipper than I am, or that's not as hip as I am. Or I'm listening to things that are sounds and or thoughts that I'm interested in. You know, so that's one track on this. I mean, the other tracks have all other reasons. And then, you know, for happening like rhythmically or sonically. And then there's also the whole question of sound. What sounds are pleasing? How often to change a sound so that the mind is really being entertained in a way it likes? The use of all of that. If my feeling is, if you do it properly, anybody or many people who listen to it will find pleasure from it, because it's a... It professes to have a truth to it. In other words, I do believe that there are 43 tones. Because if you hear people singing a cappella, you'd say, oh, that's out of tune, or that's out, or they're terrible. But no, I mean, it's the human voice going down all these different pitches between this note, and the guy's right. There are all those pitches. It's only that we divided it in that particular way that makes us think that's flat or that's sharp. So, I mean, that's a very, you know, not only is it an interesting musical thought, it's just an interesting thought, period.
When you write music over the years, you had a partner. You've had some ad hoc collaborations with people, like you did you performed with Sting.
Yeah.
You did a tour with him. But I'm assuming that you haven't done a lot of that, have you? Have you had a lot of opportunities to do that and it's not that interesting to you, or... When it happens with Sting, how does that happen?
Well, Sting, you know, that's a performance, a collaboration. That happened because we were both singing at a fundraising event. We both were supposed to sing at a fundraising event, you know, just the acoustic guitar. And so we said, okay, let's do it together and we'll sing two duets, you know, let's pick the songs. So that's how that happened. But otherwise... I do lots of. Contacted by Aaron Neville, who's my friend, who said, "Let's do something."
He's my neighbor. I see him on the street all the time.
He is. Where I live with. You know, I mean, I'm definitely going to do something with Aaron Neville. I just did something with Dion. It's really good too.
Wow.
It's really good. You know, I mean, it's interesting. So, I mean, these are various things that I think, you know, that I think of. And the fact that it's not the mainstream, well, it's, I don't know. It's neither here nor there. I mean, hate to say it is what it is, but it is what it is. That's what I do with my time and my thoughts. I'm not making any case for it. The only case I can make for that is what I do is entertaining, and then... You know, and I'd say, oh, okay, so I'm the way I'm thinking is good.
At the time that you collaborated with Garfunkel, would you write songs and you'd he was in your head and he was in the music DNA-wise when you were writing the music? I'm assuming so, when you were together. And the follow-up to that is, do you find that now sometimes you write songs and that comes, is it an old habit that can come in for you? Not even necessarily him, somebody else. Do songs come to your head sometimes that you write? Music seems to be passing through you like waves, you know, and when that happens, you ever sit there and go, oh, I would need someone else to do that with me?
No more. No, not anymore.
No.
Something else, I mean, well, first of all, to go all the way back to the times that I sang with Artie, since we started singing together, it was kind of natural for me to, in what I wrote, for the two of us to sing it. I didn't spend any time thinking about what I should do that's going to be good for the two, you know, singable for the two of us. What I was writing was singable for the two of us, and it probably didn't separate until I wrote Bridge Over Troubled Water, which, you know, when I wrote that, I said, well, Artie should sing that. You know, not, it shouldn't be two voices. Artie should sing that, and, you know. But otherwise, I really didn't spend a lot of time thinking about who, you know, who. I just sort of just keep writing the songs. They're mostly about my life, you know. I'm not writing for somebody. I'm not writing for somebody else.
You don't want to talk about your life, but your life's in the music.
Yeah, to the degree to which I would talk about.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I'm not pretending that I'm a cipher, you know. I mean, you can infer lots about who I am in my life from the information that's available. But that's, you know, I wish it wasn't available.
It's weird times we live in that way.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, without getting into any of that, you know, kind of stuff. I mean, my own life, it's like, I just can't believe how much
definitely,
it's like.
Yeah.
It's like there's people there, while you and I are sleeping, there's people doing push-ups in the garage, and they wake up and they want to kill you. You know, they want to deconstruct you and take
you
down.
It's a really big distraction if you're trying to work on some problem that you really can't quite grasp anyway, which is what's always going on with me and the music and the writing. It's like I'm just can't quite grasp that problem, and then you keep pushing, and when you do... If you do it right, then you solve the problem. Great. Now, what's the next problem?
I remember, and I'll never forget, you know, I've certainly had my public relations reversals. And what I've realized is I don't want you to love me or hate me. Now I get up there. I do what I do. If you like it, great. If you don't like it. But I don't do the salesmanship anymore at all. I just don't do it.
Well, of course not, because it really takes a lot of energy and thought to do that. And if you're spending your energy and thought on that, then you're not spending it on what you're interested in, which is however you think about acting and movies and that. And that's why they came to you in the first place, because they liked what you did. So now they're going to distract you with something, and you won't be able to do what you did as well. And then they'll say, oh, he doesn't do it as well. So for the job for the artist is to say, I can't pay too much attention to you, or I can't get this done. You know, at a certain point, okay, you know.
How's the business changed? I mean, that's a common question.
Well,
but for
I was
you,
just going to say, but in a certain sense, you know, there's it's not like this is a, it's not a very profitable business. It's been like that for a long time, you know, with the exception of a couple of acts at the top, and the records don't sell anywhere near what they did. But it's a long change that's coming, and I assume that eventually the digital world will start to pay musicians the way they used to pay them. Right now, it's not you can't really make a great living at it. But having said that, for me, since I'm not in the position of needing to make a living, fortunately, you know, I'm grateful for that. I can spend time thinking about this, which is either an indulgence on my part or is a worthwhile investigation, depending upon how people listen to it and what they say afterwards. If they say great, then okay.
Some people sold their songwriting royalties, I mean, their rights over the years. I mean, the Beatles themselves sold a lot of that and then got it back. And you didn't. Was there ever a time when people just came to you and tried to wrestle from you they tried to tempt you to buy? Because I'm saying this in hopefully a flattering way, because your music is so enduring and so, you know, truth and beauty and abundance, and it's going to play forever. And you wonder, are they going to, do people come to you and just try to make you some insane offer to kind of run off with your song rights?
No.
No.
No. Yeah, there have been offers to buy it. I don't see that I would want to sell that.
Yeah, no, of course not. If you didn't, yeah. How wonderful for you that you didn't. You know, in terms of just, you have that control.
Yeah, I'm lucky that I grew up in the record business here in New York, so, you know, I knew about having your own publishing company, which was nothing. All you had to do was file some papers with Albany, and you were a company. And then you could publish your own songs. Nobody was selling songs the way publishers used to, so nobody was entitled to any of it. So you start your own publishing company, and I did. And, you know, luckily, I started with The Sound of Silence. And what's your question?
At a different time, you see the way that the business is now and how tough it is to sell recordings and to make a living, quote unquote, to make a good living in this business. And people, maybe they thought that would never evolve that way. And for whatever reason, they sold their music rights. Mm-hmm. And they made a lot of money. What was a lot of money back then? I'm sure that they felt that they were doing the right thing. And nearly everybody I know that did that regretted that. I mean, they were, you always, the rights to your intellectual property is king, and you want to hold on to that. I think it's how fortunate for you that you were able to do that.
Well, you know, it's got to be a very difficult thing for somebody to sell the thing that they made. You know, even if they're really well compensated, you're still. It's not, you don't have any distance from that product. It's your work. It's you. You know, so you're selling it. It's got to be some level of discomfort with that, you know. Even if you say, look, hey, I'll take this level of discomfort for this much money. Okay, I will.
It better be.
Okay, yeah, maybe.
Well, let's take a quick, can we have the music? What are we playing? Have you been told?
I don't know what we want to do with this, because nobody's ever heard this.
Are you comfortable with us playing this over the radio?
I have to think about that for a minute. I was just going to play it for you.
Okay.
At this point in our interview, Paul Simon plays me a new song, Insomniac's Lullaby.
Well, I'm afraid to ask you any questions now as we come to the end of our time together. But are you an insomniac? Do you have trouble sleeping? Or are you a good sleeper?
No,
you are?
Yeah, good sleeper.
You're a good sleeper. I only ask that because I have terrible insomnia. It rules my life. I mean, and I just don't. You're a good sleeper.
I have a lot of nightmares.
Well, you opened that door now. What do you think that's about?
Oh, no, I didn't open any door. I'm just telling you that.
Okay, I'm sorry. You're right.
Yeah,
you're
just saying. That's all, yeah. No, we were just having a casual conversation about sleep.
What's going to happen to this music? You're going to release this? You don't know?
Oh, yeah.
You are?
Oh, sure. As soon as I finish, I'll put it out and see what it says. And then I'll probably go and play it live, you know? It's tough to play some of this stuff live, but... Well, figure it out. And I like my band. You know, it's the band that was on tour with Sting. And I like to, that's my band. I like to go out and play.
Play
new music and not, you know. I don't want to play, I don't know if I, if I'm, I'd like to play some smaller theaters now. I like that sound the best of the, you know, I think like 3,000 seat, 4,000 seat. 2,500 to 4,000, that size has the best sound.
By the way, I did hear 42 notes inside of each octave there. I heard a lot. I heard at least 40.
Yeah, those were the instruments.
I heard something going.
Yeah.
It sounded different.
Yeah. It is different.
But when you record, are there spaces that turn you on, or that's irrelevant, the environment?
No, it's not in the studio... studios are disappearing, but the thing that you always looked for in the studio was how did it sound.
And what was a lucky studio for you?
There were lots of them in New York. I mean, but they've mostly closed. Well, A&R was a studio that existed for a long time. It's been closed forever. There's no more Columbia studios here. The Hit Factory is gone. There's only, you know, there's Avatar. That's a good place. That has a good studio. And there are rooms that are, you know, really good rooms. And in the history of recording, that really used to be the case. Like, I mean, I went to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, to record because that place had, those guys and that place had a sound. You just turned on the switch and there it was, you know. It was just, you know, it was magic. And then that's not the way music is made today. I don't think. I don't know. I really don't know how. I don't think that's the way music is made.
Who would you love to go into a studio with and make a record with? Just one example.
There's just too many examples is what it is. The way I make music is not in collaboration with somebody. Maybe that would work. I don't think so, though. You know? Edie and I have written some songs together, and we're pretty close. And it's hard to get the balance right when you're collaborating on writing if you're just used to writing your own songs. Mm-hmm.
It's not what you
anyway,
do.
So there's nobody. So there's the people that I like want to work with are maybe somebody who's like a specifically great at playing a pipe organ in a big cathedral, you know, because like I did that. It wasn't a cathedral; it was a big church. So I need that player. Then there's. There's a drummer, a really great jazz drummer, Jack DeJohnette, and he's playing on one of the tracks. And Bobby McFerrin is singing on, in fact, that track that you just listened to. There's just a lot of people who are doing sounds and playing stuff that I like to work with, and I do. So maybe more often than you might think, it's people ask you to be on their record or. Even just participate. It goes on a bit.
One of the most vivid memories I have, because I've collected your music, I have everything downloaded, I mean, you name it, and listen to your music all the time. My daughter's 19 years old, and she flips out for your music. She just loves you and loves your music and plays it all the time. When the SNL 40th came, it's you alone. I mean, I said to myself, that's it right there.
Talked about some old times, drank ourselves some beers, still crazy after all these years, still crazy after all these years.
I started crying. My wife and I were crying because it was so beautiful.
I'm not the kind of man tends to socialize. I seem to lean on old familiar ways. And I ain't no fool for love songs that whisper in my ears. Still crazy after all.
My thanks to the great Paul Simon. This is Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing. Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio in association with Stony Brook Southampton Graduate Arts.